Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tuesday night's Oval Office speech was about more than the oil spill for President Barack Obama. Joining us now to talk about the larger scenario are Ohio State University political science professor Paul Beck. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, Ann.
And also associate professor of history and adjunct professor of law at OSU, David Stebbin. David,
nice
thanks
to
for being
be here.
What is the significance? It seems to me that it's significant on paper, maybe in the history books, but at an emotional level, the Oval Office speeches don't seem that important right now. What do you think, Paul? David?
Well, we've had televised addresses from the Oval Office since the 1950s, since Dwight Eisenhower. And in that era, those great big heavy TV cameras, fixed, not very mobile, there weren't a whole lot of ways easily for the president to do these sorts of addresses. And so the original idea of Oval Office addresses is that they were times when the president had something to say about something urgent, if not an outright crisis, something serious. And so that's been the original concept, and we still have it in a way, although the media environment has changed so much, the ability to give these kinds of speeches everywhere, outside, interactive, before an audience, not just behind the desk all by oneself. So the world is very different now, and I think some of the impact of this format has been lost as a result. The president had never done this before. He had never given an Oval Office address, which is interesting because he could have given one about the housing crisis, foreign affairs, issues of various kinds, the war in Afghanistan. And my impression from watching it is that he was probably right not to have used this format before because it didn't seem the most effective format for him. In other words, I think he works better with an audience. And my mental picture, and perhaps this is just me because I'm a political historian, is that you're supposed to have a certain amount of gravitas, you know, when you're sitting there. And he looks young still. A little bit like President Kennedy.
Or Bobby Jindal from Louisiana.
That's right. And so it's not his best format was my take. They were smart about it in the sense that it wasn't long. It was only 17 minutes. And not a whole lot of it was original. In other words, it was more of a sort of summary of things he's been saying before to smaller audiences. So I think it shows he's committed to solving the problem or addressing the problem, and that's good. But it's not – I don't think it has the impact that these kinds of speeches once did.
Paul, about 18 months into his – well, is it 18 months into his term now? Or
just about.
Yeah. Was it worth the wait?
Well, I think there are a series of venues that he's used in the past. The Rose Garden, of course, for speeches, to the very dramatic speech before the Congress early into his administration. I think actually the congressional setting was the most dramatic of all, and I think David is exactly right that he really appeared to like to have the audience there and to be kind of energized by that audience. I felt he was subdued when he gave the Oval Office speech the other night, and you know, I think any of us would be. We've got an ongoing problem in the Gulf. It would be nice to say that at least the spill is over and that we can move on now to the reconstruction and the repair work that needs to be done, remedying the environmental damage, so forth and so on. But, of course, he's not in a position to be able to say that. And that, in a way, cuts into the drama and the gravitas of the situation. It's an ongoing problem in a way that other crises in some ways haven't been. You know, 9/11 was an event that hit, and then you react to that. Katrina was an event that hit, and then you react to that. This is an event that continues every day, and we're watching it almost live on television, which makes it hard for a president to kind of cut in with a sense of finality to at least one part of the crisis and a focus on, okay, now what are we going to do going forward?
If you're just joining us, my guest, that was Paul Beck, OSU political science professor, and also with me, David Stebbin, an OSU history professor and adjunct professor of law at the Moritz School of Law. What speeches will this – well, let's talk about the idea of the ongoing event. That to me posed the most obvious contrast to so many others of these kinds of speeches. And it felt like that's what took away some of the punch. There was no finality to it.
Oh, I agree with that entirely. I mean, I think that this is unlike most catastrophes and crises that we have seen over the years. It's almost like a war where there's a back and forth on the battlefield. You think of World War II or the Korean War, where things were continuing and presidents needed to speak to the issues. Obviously, the top problem for all of us is to stop the spill. And once we get that stopped, then we can begin to move beyond that actual catastrophe and to deal with the consequences of it.
The spill, David, you said that the spill, there were other topics that might have come up in since the president took office that might have warranted this and that were kind of maybe he's lucky he waited, but because maybe another topic would have elicited more emotion from him.
Well, I think that's right, and I'm glad you mentioned the lack of emotion, because something about him sitting alone did give him he does draw energy from crowds, from audiences, even if they're unfriendly.
Don't
audiences.
Most politicians, though?
I think so. Yeah, that's right. And so he was muted. It was almost dull, not the substance of the problem. That's very dramatic, but his delivery. And what I will say for the president is that he hasn't overreacted emotionally. He could have sort of, demonized British Petroleum.
Well, he did say we're addicted to oil. He sort of demonized our quote-unquote addiction to oil.
Right. But what I like anyway is that he acknowledges that there's a problem on the part of BP. There's a problem on the part of inadequate government supervision, regulation, and oversight. And there's also a problem just more generally in the sense that we're so heavily dependent on imported oil. So a less fair approach would have just singled out BP as a wrongdoer in a sort of simplistic kind of way. And he hasn't done that. But I think when presidents are this reserved in public about a crisis, there's a tendency on the part of the public most affected, people living down there, to think, is he really concerned enough about this? Because this really does affect our livelihoods, the beauty of the environment we live in, and so on. And so I do think he wanted to communicate that. It's also an election year, an off-year election year, and the Democrats have lots of challenges politically already. What they don't want is for this to add substantially to the undertow dragging them down in the off-year elections. So partly for national consumption, but also partly for sort of southern regional consumption. Yes, I hear your concerns, and I'm communicating them. There were some things in the speech that were new, at least to me, and I've tried to follow this, but it's hard to follow all of it. One was the decision to sort of clean house at Minerals Management, the part of the Interior Department that oversees offshore drilling, and in particular to pick a new head for that organization who's a former prosecutor.
And completely out of the business, I mean, as far as mineral management goes.
That's right. In other words, he is basically someone who goes after wrongdoers. And the president underscored the change in philosophy here, saying we're moving away from – we're not going to have a philosophy of minerals management and the industry working as partners. I've appointed someone who is a watchdog and someone who will prosecute wrongdoers zealously. And the question is sort of, can he make that stick? Can he make minerals management a more aggressive agency? And if he can, then the reaction from BP and others who drill offshore will be, well, to prepare better, to follow the rules and regulations better because of the certainty that they will be found out if they do not. In other words, the picture that seems to be emerging is BP did not do everything it should have, but it's because regulatory oversight became too lax. And then it's hard to justify to stockholders spending all this money on safety precautions following the letter of the regulation when the pressure from the government to do so really isn't there. And it's very expensive to drill offshore oil. And so the pressures on the companies financially when they're engaged in this are considerable. So, and also the other part that's new was, of course, the decision to name the Navy Secretary, Ray Mabus, who's a former governor of Mississippi, to head up the cleanup effort. And again, I think there's some good politics in that as well as policy in the sense that he's from the region. He knows it intimately. He was well-liked down there. He has a record of a commitment to environmental concerns. So again, the idea that the government is responding, has someone in it who cares deeply about the region as well as the issue. So those things I think were good. I just don't think, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't sense that the speech has had a huge impact one way or the other.
I would add that the lasting impact really comes from the actions that the president has announced and NBP has announced. I think the escrow fund that was established the next day.
The $20 billion
fund? Yes, the $20 billion fund is very important. I think I agree with David, the appointing Ray Mabus as somebody who can kind of oversee the reconstruction of the area is likewise important. I think the speech itself will kind of fade into the background as these other actions become more prominent, and you know, we will see how well they work. The other thing I wanted to add here is that this, I think, is a prime example, this catastrophe, of the failure to regulate effectively. There is risk that is taken all the time. Regulation is designed to try to ameliorate those risks. We have an example here with the Mineral Mining Service of what we academics and others call the capture of a regulatory agency by the industry that it regulates, where that regulatory agency is so permeated with the interests of the party being regulated, in this case BP and the oil industry more generally, that they really don't do an effective job of regulation. And obviously we need to address that problem without going too far. I mean, this is an important industry for the United States. It's certainly an important industry for the Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana and other places. And you don't want to overdo it. On the other hand, you have to do it effectively, or you encourage everyone to take these risks, because it's an economic issue, that if your competition is taking more risk and being loosely regulated and taking advantage of that, they obviously are going to capture more profits than your own company is. And so it pushes you also in the direction of kind of taking those risks up to the limits.
We have to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be with Paul Beck, OSU political science professor and also OSU history professor and adjunct professor of law, David Stebbin. If you have a question or comment for both or either, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and post your question or comment there. Do that now during our break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. At 1 o'clock, On Point will be here. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and ProPublica's T. Christian Miller on traumatic brain injuries still not being treated in thousands of returning veterans. That discussion on Point, today at 1, right here on WOSU 820.
Support for WOSU comes from the Central Ohio Unitarian Universalist Congregations, taking part in the Pride Parade Saturday, June 19th, and having services Sunday the 20th, to which all are welcome. More information at centralohiouu.info.
70 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 82. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 88. Looking ahead to Saturday, cloudy skies and a high of 91. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are David Stebbin, OSU history professor, and also Paul Beck, OSU political science professor. You know, there's sort of this all Orwellian penchant by presidents and others to invoke military terminology, no matter what the topic. It was certainly the case on Tuesday night, and he's not alone. You can go back through, and we're having a war on poverty, a war on drugs. It's always a war on something. Apparently gets people going. But how does that play when we're talking about this kind of topic, Paul?
Well, I think it's obviously a situation where you want to marshal all of the energies of government, and in this case, the private sector as well, to try to address what has been a colossal catastrophe. And so I think that we shouldn't be surprised that they evoke this kind of terminology. My sense, actually, is that it may be more dramatic But in the longer run, what matters is what gets done rather than what we say about what is getting done. And, you know, maybe the other thing to say, too, is, of course, Americans, all of us are very impatient with this particular
situation. We're impatient with everything.
Well, we've reached a point, Anne, I think, and it's a troubling point in many ways, where trust in government is so low, as is trust in the private sector, by the way. Both of these have been declining over time. It's not just an Obama administration reaction. It was there before. And what it does is that it weakens the ability of government to be able to kind of marshal the sentiment of the country to attack major problems. There's a hypercritical mode that I think we're in right now. It's almost as if no matter what President Obama does, there are going to be plenty of people who are criticizing him for doing it, even if it's what they would have done, or even if it's a situation where it's not really clear that he can do much of anything right now. You know, certainly he can, as somebody put it on the news, don his Superman cape and go down there a mile below the surface of the Gulf and cap the oil well. So there is impatience. There is distrust of government. There's distrust, really, of all institutions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the institutions that stands out where Americans ceded a great deal of trust still is the military. And so one can imagine the kinds of language focusing on kind of military allusions of one kind or another is thought to be quite effective.
David, what speeches will this be compared to? Or in your mind, what do you compare it to?
Well, I'm not sure it will be compared with any speech, in part because we don't know how this is going to play out yet. People like to use these historical analogies. Mm-hmm. So I've seen comparisons with the hostage crisis, that sort of thing, which is a very negative comparison because it did not work out well for President Carter. What I think is legitimate about the comparison is that both were kind of ongoing events, hard to know exactly when they were going to change. I think the administration waited in the hope that a quick resolution would occur. In other words, BP would succeed, along with the scientists and others working on the problem. And once that didn't happen and the magnitude of the spill, our sense of it grew, literally how much of this is being spilled into the ocean grew, then the pressure for a speech became more compelling. In that sense, I think it's more like President Kennedy's speech to the country in June of 1963 about civil rights. It was not a speech he wanted to give. He was trying in the early years of his presidency to sort of manage, contain that explosive issue. And then by May of 1963, the confrontation in Birmingham and so on made that effort unmanageable. In other words, it didn't work anymore. So the president had to go on TV and say something. And that very famous speech that he gave on civil rights was only about 15 or 16 minutes long, so comparable in length.
Is that pretty typical, that length?
I think it's actually fairly short. The other thing that's interesting about this whole situation is prior to the oil spill, very shortly before, the president had issued this executive order making it easier to drill offshore. And that moved us into a new era. In other words, before, it wasn't easy to drill offshore, so the arguments for strict regulatory oversight weren't all that compelling. In other words, the solution to the problem was we just weren't going to allow this activity. If we're going to allow more offshore drilling because we need the oil, that sense, then you have to change the regulatory part. And so that's the struggle we are now in. And the question is, can the government do that? In other words, Paul talks about this correctly, I think, that it's sort of a long-term problem that's built up. Sort of lax regulatory environment, the people in the regulatory agencies too friendly with the industries they regulate. But making a sea change back the other way is really hard to do, right? Creating a more – you want it to be almost adversarial but not truly antagonistic.
Well, it reminds me of the financial industry.
Correct.
Yep.
And so – and we didn't get that change in attitude about regulation until we had a major oil spill-like tragedy there. It's unfortunate that's the way the system tends to work. We have a big problem and then we address the problem. So but you know, if Paul is again correct, I think if from this point forward we make progress and the regulatory agency becomes much more of a watchdog, a much more intimidating presence, and so the oil companies change their behavior accordingly, then the long-term result will be positive. And there's also the environmental damage issue. And to an historian, again, I go back to the Santa Barbara oil spill, which really sort of helped push the major environmental bills of the early 70s through Congress. When that spill took place, it was very dramatic because Santa Barbara's beaches are very beautiful, and the oil spill temporarily made them a mess. And a lot of residents there wondered, is this sort of permanent, the degradation of those beaches? But in fact, using new technology, they were cleaned up. And so if the optimist in me says, well, if we devote ourselves to this effort, we can do a lot to restore what has been damaged. But given the amount of the size of the spill, the magnitude of it, it's going to take a while for that.
And it's
to
ongoing. It's not a fixed amount.
That's
yes,
right.
That's the problem, that it is ongoing as well.
It keeps piling up.
614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and speak with either of our guests today, Paul Beck and David Stubben. Caller from Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't know if you, my response to this whole issue is what you are looking for, but just before I get into my main comment, last night's speech was nothing new, and it didn't say much new, so that it didn't help me much about what he can do. From day one, I felt that Obama, President Obama, did not react urgently and quickly in a way that nobody else can do as a leader of superpower.
What would have satisfied you? What would you have him do immediately?
First of all, he should have owned up the problem along with the BP. Don't waste any breath on who is responsible. It's obviously it is BP's disaster, but the problem becomes ours because we are about to be victimized economically, environmentally, and in many ways. This is also on our security and interests. So he should have marshaled not only our governmental resources, but call on all the foreign countries who have experience with oil drilling to come help us. Assigning blame comes later. Assigning who is going to get paid, how much, this has to come later. I am so disappointed. I am the support. I am the supporter of Obama, and but his reaction is too lukewarm, too late, and too little.
All righty. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Let me chime in on this.
Sure, Paul.
I think that we need to realize that here was a situation that once it happened, there was no easy technical fix to it. The federal government does not possess the kind of specialized expertise that can handle oil wells and oil spills. It never has, and I don't think we really should expect it to. It's also clear that BP doesn't either. That they were taking risk that they really didn't know how to meet. And if we listen to the testimony before the Congress yesterday, it's also clear that none of the other oil companies have an effective plan to be able to deal with a situation of this magnitude. I don't think other countries have it either. And so it may be one of these situations where a catastrophe has happened and is continuing to happen. We don't really know what to do to stop it, at least in the short run. Now, the long-run solution, when one hopes, is to drill the alternative well and to be able to close out the one that is spewing forth all the oil. But that's going to take some time to do, and we are a mile under the surface. They're drilling through really hard material there. It just is a real challenge there. And so I don't think the president should have raised false expectations.
And he didn't.
He
said, "This, all right, here's the deal. It's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
It's not going to be over. It could be years."
Yeah, I think of it like, and the analogy I think is not entirely apt, but you know, you think of the involvement of the United States at the beginning of World War II. It was very clear that with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and what was going on in the European theater, as well that this was going to take a long time. There were going to be some reversals to it. There was no easy and quick solution to it. And if a president leads the public to expect that we can get this behind us really quickly, that president, I think, is not exerting the kind of leadership that he should. And you know, maybe the other thing.
And 8.5 years later, regarding Iraq.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I mean, there are problems like this. The attack of the North Koreans, or alleged attack, although I think it's been proven pretty clearly, of the North Koreans upon the South Korean submarine is another example that you can decry that situation. You can obviously blame people for it. The question is, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it that doesn't worsen the problem?
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Amy Jurevich, my associate producer, is getting really good at grabbing comments and questions from that, too. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I hope this doesn't come across as a stupid comment, but...
No, there is no stupid comment. Well, I've proven that over and over again.
Well, I found it very distracting and almost seemed to take away from the seriousness of the situation that he kept moving his hand. I found that very distracting, and it was more like he was just chit-chatting instead of, you know, you can almost visualize Bush sitting there with his hands folded and staring into the camera.
And you preferred that?
That's the only thing I prefer Bush over Obama. But, yeah, I think in this case, I don't know. So I'd like to hear your comments.
Yeah, David, you were nodding your head.
Right, I am nodding because my spouse is a media and public relations professional. We tend to watch these together and discuss. But even I noticed before she mentioned this sort of thing that he's an action-oriented guy. He likes an audience. He likes to be able to gesture. So having to sit absolutely still was an unnatural experience for him. So I noticed the hands moving as well, to no real point. In other words, they weren't really emphasizing anything, or they weren't communicating or helping him communicate. And I think it was simply his lack of familiarity with that format. He's
in
just
fact,
not used to it.
It made it look like he was trying to communicate with his hands to emphasize points, you know. And then you had your little... written thing there, the president's address to the nation or something. So sometimes his hands were just barely bouncing above that little thing on CBS.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
That's right. It's visually – I always think of the presidents who have done this best in a way don't move very much naturally. Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Jerry Ford, they would sit there stolidly and talk to you. Even Ronald Reagan – didn't gesture very much.
He had one of his charts in front of him.
That's right. But Reagan was special in that he was a trained Hollywood actor. So he didn't even blink. In other words, he was skilled at sitting still and reading copy. And he had started as a news person and had some training that way as well. The president also, maybe this is simply my own reaction, I was struck by how young he looked in that format.
Yeah, and I think that emphasized that it's almost, you know, nervousness or something.
Which makes me wonder. Thanks a lot, Robert, for your call.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Paul, you know, is this method of communicating with the American public, and David brought it up earlier, it's a big deal and it's historical, but is it not necessarily as effective and maybe should be rethought?
Well, one thing to say is that I think presidents learn how to do this better. We have to realize that for somebody in their 18th month of being president, most of their experience has come from the campaign and on the stump, or in the case of President Obama, speaking in the well of the Senate. And these are not the kinds of forums that we see in the Oval Office of the White House. My guess is they're talking about this speech in the White House, the communications people there, diagnosing what they see as problems, strengths, weaknesses, and so forth. And they probably will learn from that. Reagan, as I think David pointed out quite well, was very practiced at doing this. He was very familiar with these kinds of venues. Few other presidents are, and they can get better at this over time. They get all kinds of advice. You know, everybody's giving advice right now to President Obama about what he should and shouldn't do. The problem, of course, is that nobody is giving quite the same advice as anybody else. So it's kind of hard to know what to take out of this.
David and I were talking earlier about all the advice he's getting. For instance, David Broder today, or was it yesterday?
It's in his column published today in the Dispatch, I believe.
Right, that he should just forget about it. David, well, is this even humanly possible at this point?
No,
it was kind of an odd thing to say.
Well, I think the Broder's, and he's very senior, very distinguished political correspondent and pundit with the Washington Post Company, is concerned that the president not spend so much time on this that he neglect other things. And one thing I will say in the president's defense in this regard is that he has an awful lot on his plate nationally and internationally. One thinks of the conflict in Afghanistan, the situation in Iraq, in the Koreas, as well as the domestic economy, which is what most people are still most focused on, creating jobs, restoring some stability and improvement to the housing market. So honestly, my sort of reaction to this is that the initial impulse was not to spend too much effort on this rhetorically, this issue of the oil spill, in the hope that it would quickly be solved and because there's so much else going on. And then when that became an unworkable approach, then what to do next? So it isn't as if the government hasn't reacted, but the president's personal engagement with it has grown as the problem has worsened. But he's, you know, he's a very busy person. It highlights the problems of this office. In other words, it's one person. I mean, he has a staff and so on. But if you have multiple serious challenges, how is it possible for any one person to spend enough time on all of them, enough time in the sense of satisfying the people most affected by it? And so I do think his speeches to groups down in the Gulf, and I've watched some of these online, have been much better. In other words, when he's there and talks to groups, he communicates effectively his concern and so on. This was a chance or an attempt to sort of address the issue nationally, and I don't think it went as well.
But let me add 2 points to what David has said. One is that presidents have to be multitaskers. And they often, of course, come into office with an agenda of issues and challenges that they want to address. But very quickly, they find that there are a whole bunch of other things that crowd onto that agenda that they hadn't anticipated. And you can kind of go down the list for Obama. There are a whole bunch of things that have come onto his agenda that he had not really planned for, and he obviously has to deal with them. And then the other point that I wanted to make is that Obama has to deal with this, has to give at least some attention to this. And the reason is that the public expects him to. And I remember early in my career as a political scientist, I studied how children react to politics. And one thing that's very, very clear is that children see the presidency and the president as a larger-than-life figure, as sort of a parent in a way, who, when they're very young, is going to be the one who solves the kinds of problems that they face. And there is still that in adults. You know, there's kind of that residue of feeling that if it's not the president, who else is going to be able to comfort you at this time of catastrophe in the Gulf? It gets played out hour after hour after hour on television, and we see it in a way that 50 years ago we didn't see things happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think a president has to respond to this, but has to respond to this in a way that is responsible, that doesn't raise expectations, nonetheless is comforting to some degree, as much as he can be, and also says to the people in the Gulf who are really suffering under this, I understand your suffering, and we will put things in place to try to respond to that, but these are not easy things to do, and they're not things that can be done immediately.
We have to take a short break. In the meantime, if you want to connect with us, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll hear how the public can support the troops, veterans, and their families, including local volunteer opportunities. That discussion at 11 right here on WOSU 820. Hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides. 71 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41. Sunshine today, a high of 82. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and warmer with a high of 88. For Saturday, cloudy skies and a high of 91. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the president's speech on Tuesday night and his reaction and response to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. My guests, David Stebbin, OSU history professor and OSU political science professor, Paul Beck. 614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment, like Susie. Susie, you grew up around Santa Barbara, California. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, in Southern California. Okay. And that's why I wanted to correct the record, because I grew up near Encinitas, or at least we spent half our time down there. And it's about 250 miles south, and the beaches have still not recovered. And there's still tar.
How do you know? How do you see that?
Tar. Hmm. And there have been other problems with the beaches because they've dredged for the gas company. So energy has caused a lot of damage to the beaches there. But I did really want to emphasize that they cannot clean up. And that was a comparatively tiny spill. Mm-hmm. And tar is still washing up on the shore from that spill all those years ago.
Now, do you think that the topic was worthy of an Oval Office address?
Yes. But what's so sad is that President Obama approved more deep water drilling without proper research in the first place. These people were operating blind, and I just think it's such a tragic thing for our country.
Thanks for your call, Susie.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And a very good.
Go
ahead,
worth
Paul.
Adding that even though he had announced an approval of more deep water drilling, the particular drilling here in the Gulf was a product of earlier decisions, not his
right.
decision. Now, obviously, he is backing away from that decision, and I think he should until we can figure out how we can try to guard against the kind of risk that's involved.
You know,
we can.
One point of conflict, and maybe it's been resolved, but that I still sense is what happens to the idled oil workers during this moratorium, and the president saying they should be among those who – well, he's saying they will be among those who could press claims against BP, and BP saying, no, they shouldn't be. You're forcing this moratorium on us. They shouldn't be part of the beneficiaries.
Right, and the moratorium issue is complicated because it isn't just the companies that are unhappy with it. Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat of Louisiana – is really very unhappy about the moratorium because of what it means for employment in her state. And so there are workers as well who are not happy with the moratorium approach. In other words, I think there's a lot of pressure on the system to figure out improved regulation and get it going so that the industry can resume drilling. In terms of the decision to drill in the first place, to expand offshore drilling, the question is, are the pressures to find new oil now so overwhelming that they sort of overcome the older, strong environmental protection objection? And I really like the comment from the caller, Susie, who grew up in Southern California, because it's a very good reminder. The beaches in Santa Barbara, where that famous oil spill took place in 1969, they look fine. And that's a very prosperous resort community. Farther down the coast, mm-hmm. where she grew up, there's still residue left over. And so it points to the difficulty I don't think you can, in a situation like this, restore 100% of what was there before, the environmental beauty. What you can do is clean up. You can do something very substantial. But it points out that there's just an ongoing trade-off. If we're going to drill more, there will be costs for the environment. Whether the costs for the environment are outweighed by the gains of finding more oil for Americans is something ultimately the electorate is going to decide in those states and nationally.
David, I think, by the way, has put it very well, that it's a matter of trying to strike the right balance between or in trading off some very difficult values. And that's what public policy making is all about, and it's not an easy process.
614-292-8513. Jeff, you're on the air. I don't know if you just heard David Stebbins mention that one of the president's most vocal critics has been Mary Landrieu, and she's a Democrat. And you wanted to talk about the Republicans' response.
Well, yes, but Mary Landrieu is, as I would guess you would consider, a blue dog Democrat. She's a rather moderate, conservative Democrat. But I'm trying to, and I understand she's in Louisiana, oil-producing state. But mm-hmm. I'm not sure I understand this Republican strategy, which seems to be whatever Obama does is either too late, too little, too much, or something on all three categories, because they bash him for say he's playing golf or not taking this seriously, and then he comes up with negotiating the $20 billion escrow fund. But I haven't heard any Republican saying, well, that was a step in the right direction.
Has anyone trashed that, though? I'm not hearing a lot of trash talk on the $20 billion escrow fund. Are you?
Me, personally?
Yeah.
I have not yet, but okay. I haven't heard any I haven't heard David Bitter or Mitch McConnell or certainly Sarah Palin or anyone
say,
like that.
Good job, President.
There's no attaboys there.
No, that's politics these days, isn't it?
Well, and I do think the context here is that Obama and the Democrats made a lot of political capital out of the inept Bush administration response to Katrina. And so this gives the Republican opposition, they feel, a chance to do some of the same. In other words, to criticize the president as not sufficiently engaged and on top of the problem. And it's almost eerily parallel in that it's the same region of the country. And so for the Democrats, what they want to do is strike a strong contrast. In other words, President Bush, too free market, too disengaged from the problem. Katrina's a mess. We, on the other hand, more activist in our approach, we've addressed this problem. So far, that narrative is not developing in the way the Democrats would like.
You know, that is interesting. It is the same region, but in the case of Katrina, there was a disproportionate impact on poor people. BP oil spill it affects everybody in the country if you care about the Gulf, if you like seafood, if you like the beaches in Florida.
Right. Well, I always think of what's the Central Ohio connection? A lot of Central Ohioans have older relatives who have settled on the Gulf Coast of Florida. There are certain places on the Gulf Coast of Florida, if you're there for spring break, it feels like you're in Buckeye land, literally. And for those folks, you wouldn't naturally think that there'd be a familial connection to the middle of Ohio, but there really is, because if those beaches on the west coast of Florida are significantly damaged, that's going to affect the quality of life of the people who live there, including their relatives.
Here? Yeah, Jeff?
I'm just been thinking, I keep hearing this Katrina comparison, mm-hmm. and I guess I understand the sort of maybe automatic response because it is in the same area, but where Katrina focused not just on a natural disaster, this is a man-made disaster. Katrina also brought up issues of poverty and race,
right.
and the government response. Maybe Obama's photo of him stooping, checking that beach out is going to be sort of haunt him the same way as Bush's standing in the middle of that empty square with those floodlights that they brought in, mm-hmm. and then they took off when it was done. But I'm looking for some moral equivalency here, and I don't see, maybe I'm being overly partisan, but I think it's apples and oranges. I think I understand the political response here, but I don't understand how Republicans think they can sell the whole idea of don't bash BP.
Well, Paul, do apples and oranges make any sense in politics? Does it make any difference?
Well, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. I think what the Republican response is, what they're trying to do is reach for something that gives them some partisan advantage. And parties do this, and we understand that. They're going to try out various things. It's kind of interesting that John Boehner, the minority leader in the House, kind of came to the defense of BP, and then he pulled back very quickly from that, realizing that wasn't going to play. And so they will try other things. But it all speaks to this dilemma that is there. And that is that Louisiana and other parts of the Gulf are in some ways economically dependent upon oil and drilling.
Mm-hmm.
They are, of course, economically dependent upon the seafood industry, on the tourist industry, where people come to their beaches. All of these things now are jeopardized. And one has jeopardized the others, which is, I think, really the dilemma there. And what the country needs to do, and of course the president is involved in this deeply, but it's more than just the president, we need to strike the right balance there. And it's hard to figure out what that is right now. It's particularly hard, I think, to focus on striking that right balance when we're in the midst of huge amounts of oil being spilled out into the Gulf continually and not being able to even stop that.
Jeff, thanks for your call. Appreciate
Thank you.
It. Take care. 614-292-8513, or you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, comment there, or you can go to allsides@wosu.org, send us an email. Let's see. I think Brenda?
Ann, I wanted to
yeah,
mention
sure.
something about approval figures of the president.
Yes.
We measure, the pollsters do, how the president is doing. It seems like almost daily. And the interesting thing is that Obama's been hovering just a little bit below 50% in those approval figures, and there doesn't seem to have been much change during this crisis in the Gulf. Now, that's not to say there wouldn't be erosion down the road. There obviously could be. But for right now, this doesn't seem to have cut into his approval.
His overall approval ratings now, there is a little bit higher percentage of people who aren't happy with how he's responded to it.
Yes.
But the overall ratings haven't changed.
And it's interesting to strike a contrast that if you look at the same point in their presidencies, he is above where Ford was, he's above where Carter was, he's above where Ronald Reagan was, he's above where Bill Clinton was. At this point, in some of those cases, of course, the president became much more or got much more approval over time past this point. So a lot can happen between now and the time that he runs for re-election, which is, of course, the critical time in bringing his approvals into the picture of voting.
Brenda, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You want to talk about our overall response to these kind of disasters?
Yes. Thanks for a good conversation today so far. Getting beyond politics and besides the very importance of prevention, when I look at the disasters of the recent decades, say, the response to Katrina was awful. In Haiti, 6 days after the earthquake, I seemed to be screaming to the television, can't someone just drop food from a plane somewhere? 9/11, we all at first thought Rudy Giuliani's response was great, but now all the volunteers going through the rubble are getting lung disease because apparently they weren't provided the right kind of respirators, and that's now seeming not to have been a good response. And with this oil disaster, the country seems to want more in the way of big ships and booms and something preventing that oil from reaching shore. Looking at the big picture, what does society need to do to respond to disasters better?
Well, these aren't just any old garden variety disasters, though. These are unprecedented. So how do you plan for something you've never had before? I mean, is that even possible, Paul?
Well, and that may be the problem here, that in terms of the oil spill, this is of a magnitude that we have never seen before in a place that is much more vulnerable than most places, perhaps, for this kind of damage. I don't think we do a good job of handling these things. And part of it is lack of experience in doing that. Part of it is the difficulty of knowing what to do I was very interested in the debates over how to prevent the oil from surging into the marshes and, yeah. And the beaches of Louisiana. There, it's very clear that there are some things that have been proposed that could worsen the situation rather than improve it. And so we need to be very, very careful about how we move forward here and get as much technical expertise devoted to the question as we can, but with the realization in the end that because we don't have much experience with this, even the technical experts may not agree on what it is we ought to do and what would be the best approach to it.
Brenda, thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bottom line, David, you've said that it's probable that this is not a memorable speech. It won't be remembered over time, but what will be remembered about this then and the Barack Obama administration and its response?
Well, I think Paul was quite correct. We talk about politics on a regular basis, that the political situation at the moment is very fluid. There's a lot of anti-incumbent sentiment in the country. What the president needs to do is going forward, show that things are being accomplished, that this problem is being addressed successfully. And if it is, and related to that, prevention. In other words, the previous caller said, you know, how could we better deal with these crises? And I think the real lesson here is that you have stronger regulation and then you avoid – in other words, it's so much less expensive to have stricter policing to prevent this sort of thing than to try to deal with the catastrophe after it happens.
Paul Beck, I know you have to take off, so I'm going to say goodbye to you first. Thank you so much for joining our program today.
Okay, Ann and David, good to be with you.
Thank you.
And David Stubbin, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
We are out of time for this segment of All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.